Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora.
Yo, 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 what's up, y'all? This is Fonte, Fontigolo, and this is yet another QLS classic with Otis Williams from the legendary Temptations. This one was from June 13, 2018. One of the few episodes I had to miss. I hate I had to miss this one. This really hurt my heart. Legendary baritone singer, founding member of the Temptations, Otis Williams. He discusses everything from his evolution of Motown, the band's dynasty, and their album All the Time. It's going down right here on QLS Classics, right here on Questlove Supreme. All right, peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a special Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove Jenkins, and with me today is Boss Bill, Sugar Steve, and it's Laia. Team Supreme. Today we are celebrating a legacy. For the past six decades, our next guest was the glue that held together one of the most tightest, elegant music dynasties in the history of modern Western music. Their brand of sophisticated pop and soul with such gems as My Girl, The Way You Do, The Things You Do, and Ain't Too Proud to Beg, just to name a few, was just as crucial to the civil rights era as Lift Every Voice and Sing. There isn't a vocal group or band active today or in the past who has not been influenced by them. From their immaculate vocal harmony structure, to their choreography, to their outfits, to their songs of love that have stood the test of time, to their political anthems, just as relevant in 2018 as it was in 1968. Music would not be what it is today without the Temptations, and the Temptations would not be the everlasting institution it is without the one and only heartbeat of the Temptations. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our guests, Sir Otis Williams, to Questlove Supreme.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Worthy of this praise.
Thank you.
Yes, yes.
Thank you, Quest.
I should become a preacher.
Yeah. You rattled that off real good.
You know, I'm gonna do something a little different than I normally do on the show. Well, I want to ask you. Normally, I go back to the beginning, but I want to ask you, what keeps you going?
Well, Quest, on the real side, it's love what I do. You know, when you stop and think about this world that we live in and all the people that inhabit this world, there's a small microcosm of us that get a chance to do what we'd like to do for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, and God has blessed me to be able to ride the hair off the horse. So I'm enjoying this here. You know, it's a labor of love. And when you can bring happiness to the world over in by way of music, you know, music have been able to do some things that politicians haven't been able to do. Mm-hmm. So I love what I do, and I'm thankful to God for, you know, still being able to do it after 58 years.
Yeah, that's impressive. And as someone that's at the epicenter of a group of people, and not controlling them per se, but I know the headaches. The daily headaches that it takes to manage different band attitudes and uh-huh. whatever. I mean, be it.
Yeah, you're trying to put it nice.
Politically correct.
But, yeah, right.
I'm just saying that, like, I admire you so much, and you know, I've read your book when I was like 17. Your autobiography that came out, and like I know that being the glue of an institution is one of the hardest things, like where you wake up daily or weekly trying to figure out what ops can I get through this day without drama. And, you know, I know that you've gone through like members of the group and arguments, like,
all that.
Is it worth it? That's really my question. Is it worth it at
the
end of
the
day to you?
Look, I look at it. First of all, you're dealing with people. When you understand that you're dealing with people, then you have to really understand that a lot of, you know, things come along with that. And it's worth it, you know, because when we're on stage and we hear and see people with tears in their eyes, and I'm not talking about ladies, I'm talking about grown men, you know, and we were on one night a few weeks ago, and my road manager said, Doogie, his name is Doogie, we call him Doogie, he said, Otis, you have got to see this little three-year-old boy playing with his car, and he's like, dee-doo-dee-da, doo-doo-doo-doo-da. He's 3 years old. So when you see from 3 years old all the way up to almost 100, mm-hmm. it's worth it. You know, you just have to put up with you know, the shenanigans and the moods and the what have you with people, you know. But God has helped me to make it through this. And Berry Gordy and a lot of the heavyweights at Motown and thereabout have said, Otis, you are the glue that holds the Temptation together. And I figured that, hey, if my shoulders are big enough and strong enough to do it, then it's well worth the wait. Because when I'm at home and I walk around my house and look at of all the things that I've achieved, mm-hmm. oh, it's worth it. You know, it would be like me crying with a loaf of bread under my arms. So I really can't complain.
Okay.
I got to take that into account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like this guy.
You would, Steve.
So in the days of the Elgins, before you became the Temptations, first of all, how did you guys, what was the transformation from the Elgins to the Temptations?
Well, even before the Elgins, my group was called Otis Williams in the Distance. Mm-hmm. We were with a little small label called Northern Records, and the lady that ran the label, Johnny Mae Matthews, she recorded us. And we had a nice little regional hit called Come On. Mm-hmm. And it did very well, so much so that she sold the masters to Warwick Records. And so one day she came from New York back to Detroit, and she just taking out all these $100, you know, slapping them these $100 bills. And I was about this, I'm about 17, 18 years old. And she said, well, you guys, your record's going to be here all over America. I sold it to Warwick Records, and now they can hear it all over the world. And I said, oh, that's good. Do we get some royalties for that? Because I wrote the first little regional hit. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me with a jaunty's eye. She said, you ain't going to get none of this money. This is my money. Now, we were doing record hops back during those days, and record hops is where you go around to the disc jockeys, record hops, and so they can continue to play your records. Mm-hmm. So Smokey Robinson and the Miracles were very hot at the time, and Mr. Gordy was with them. So we could see them from the stage, and as they were coming in, we came off, and Mr. Gordy said, I like your group, your record. If you should leave where you are, come see me. And I did, you know, because Johnny Mae had said we weren't going to get any of that money. Mm-hmm. So I called Mr. Gordy, and he said, come on over here and see Mickey Stevens, who was the A&R man. So Johnny Mae kept the name, that Otis Williams in the Distance. So I guess being young and whatever, I said, well, keep the name. We young, we'll start all over again. So when we got over to Motown, we stood out front of a building called the legal department of Motown. Mm-hmm. And a guy named was Bill Mitchell. He said, so what are we going to call you guys? And we stood there. He said, what about the Temptations? I said, I like that. And at the time, David Ruffin wasn't in the group, but Al Bryan, mm-hmm. Eddie Kendricks, Paul Williams, and Melvin Franklin and myself, we were the No Name group at the time. So I said, I like that. And I asked Paul, I'd rather I asked all the guys, but Paul Williams said, Otis, a name is whatever we make it. So I said, Temptations. So Bill hollered back up to legal department, put on the contract, the Temptations. And so 1961 all the way up till now, we have been known as the Temptations.
The movie totally got that wrong. They over-dramatized that whole thing. They said y'all was sitting outside for like 8 hours trying to figure out outside of Hitsville.
Yeah, we was out.
And then you come in, and then Mr. Gordy says, well, what's your name? Because I can't have y'all be whatever y'all said y'all was.
Right, right.
And y'all were like, we got to make it sexy.
Yeah.
Yeah, they over-dramatized that whole thing.
Well, you know what I learned when I say, because I'm going to be honest with you, I have yet to sit and watch that miniseries.
What? Seriously?
Right in the gut.
I think I understand that, but...
I can tell
it's
you
weird
why.
Because now they show it so much.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I learned, the little bit that I saw, the scene where as Melvin Franklin and myself had to go to David Ruffin's apartment. Now, the guy that played me, what is his name? Charles Malik, mm-hmm. D.B. Woodside, who played Melvin, and naturally Leon. Mm-hmm. So I'm standing in the shadows and the way they're getting the lighting and everything all fixed up. So Alan Arkus, the director, said, all right, action, camera, roll them. The girl came up with the glass board, bap. And the two brothers that played Melvin and myself knocked on the door, and Leon opened the door. And when they started to deliver their lines, I said, oh, no, I can't watch this. Now, we're talking about the year 1998, but when that incident happened, it was 1966. Mm-hmm. So it lets you know that there was still a lot of stuff down underneath. So one day we're in New York where my players getting ready to open up. I mean, in D.C., mm-hmm. at the Kennedy Center. Yeah. And Smokey mm-hmm. heard that I hadn't seen the movie. He said... He calls me Oak. Oak? You mean you haven't seen your movie? I said, no, Smokey, I don't want to cry. Oak? you need to watch a movie. I said, well, I'll get around to watch it. I said, well, let me ask you something, Smokey. Have you watched it? Oh, I'll watch it. I said, did you cry? Yeah, I cried. So you need to get you a box of Kleenex and sit down and watch it. I have yet to watch it. But when I saw it up in Berkeley, I sat there and the play is very touching. It's going to be seen that you need to take a Kleenex.
So wait, what's the difference? Because there's a play versus the miniseries that we saw.
Well, the play is very touching in the sense of you get another kind of feel in person. And so as I'm sitting there watching it, the people that's sitting around me, they would watch the play and they would do like this here.
Get a glance at you.
Yeah, they want to see if I'm crying. And true enough, tears welling up in my eyes because there's a scene where it's, the white folks are shooting at us down south. And now we went through all that. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's been very real. But, you know, I'm very glad that, I was able to put it in paper. Now from that to it'll start next month in D.C. And it'll be there for 5 weeks and then it'll go to L.A. and then from L.A. To Toronto, and then hopefully they have Broadway. They're just waiting for the right theater. Yeah. And the name of it is Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations.
Yeah, I got to meet the people that produced that.
Ira Pittleman.
The sister that wrote the screenplay.
Oh, Detroit girl.
It's amazing.
And do you at least have anything to do with the casting, either the miniseries or the play for the person who plays you? Do you care? Do you mind?
Well, at first I wanted Leon to play me because Leon and I were pretty close. You know, when we got the green light that it was going to be done on NBC, I said, hey, man, they're going to do the Tim's Life Story. I would love for you to play me. He said, listen, man, you know, you my man. I'd be glad to play you. So the Tim's, we went to Paris to do a one-nighter. Mm-hmm. So by the time we came back from Paris, my manager, Shelley, said, well, got the green light. We're going to do it. And but I got to tell you good news and bad news. I said, okay, what's that? He said, well, Leon is going to be in the miniseries. I said, oh, good. So what's the bad news? He's going to play David Ruffin. What Leon did while we were over in Paris, Leon went and got the pants that we used to wear back then called the Continental Type all the way down. He went and got his hair, you know, like David used to wear in the glasses.
Wow.
Yeah, and when he walked into the casting with all the powers to be that was sitting there, Suzanne in the past, and him said, you play David Ruffin. And that's how he got the role.
It's weird that you haven't seen it because one of the most iconic lines from it that's become an internet meme is, nobody's coming to see you.
I've been getting that question everywhere. But look at me now, though. I'm still here. Yeah.
So when you guys started at Motown, explain to our listeners the idea of the Charm School. Going through, well, first of all, just the idea of, what was the idea behind wanting to present
that
and a sophisticated
look
to America? What was it before, and why was that such a revolutionary move?
Well, I think, you know, talent a lot of times need to be cultivated. You know, you can have all the talent in the world, but it's one thing to know how to present yourself when you are, really out on Front Street. And I have to give those accolades to, a lot of people say Barry Gordy. No, I have to give a credit to Harvey Fuqua. Yeah. Harvey Fuqua was from the Moonglows, and he knew Charlie Atkins. And so in the process of Motown really becoming the iconic label it is known for today, evidently Harvey must have met with Barry and said, you know, we need to groom these talented kids. And so Barry felt as though it would be a good idea. And they opened up a artist development right across the street from Hitsville. We had to be there when it was time for us to rehearse from 10 in the morning to 5 to 6 o'clock in the evening. And it was headed by the late, great Charlie Atkins, the late, great Maurice King, who was our vocal coach, and Charlie was our choreographer. Johnny Allen, who would be at the piano and, you know, keeping everything, theoretically, musically correct. And they sat down and they would tell us how to really carry ourselves. You know, it's one thing to have all the talent in the world, but if there's one thing I hate, and I'm always trying to be cognizant of it, I hate for artists get on, you know, do interview. Well, them now do dudes, and you know, don't talk correctly. Right. They said you guys need to know how to talk, you know, because the world will be watching you. And they told us things like four things Maurice King said: don't get involved with. You can never tell nobody about how they spend their money, religion, who they make love to, and it's the fourth one, politics. Did I say politics? Mm-mm. That. So, and we've had that occasion to come up, and I'm so glad that I had that kind of knowledge being taught at Motown, you know. So, but they really, you know, put a lot into us because they were grooming us to go come to the Copacabana in the smart rooms. So we would have to rehearse from 10 in the morning to 6 in the evening, and it paid off because, you know, I look at a lot of the early films, and I can see where the proper presentation and how to carry ourselves and how to present ourselves in the sense of speaking, interviews, and what have you. So it is one of the only company, I believe, that ever had that. There will never, ever be another Motown.
So would you guys, I know that at least in the 60s, to play the Copa right. was like the dream.
Yes.
But similar to how Sam Cooke would do it, like if you were playing the Black venue, then he did the sure. Show Enough, Get Down,
yeah, right,
you know, Sweat Off My Brow,
right
rebel rousing show, but right. If at the Copa, then suit and tie. So would you guys have dual shows depending on who the audience was?
No.
So even Mellow Mood Temptations would play the Apollo to that particular when, crowd
after and, we open up at the Copa, because we hold all the existing records at the Copa. Mm-hmm. We went to the Apollo and we opened up with Hello Young Lovers. And
really?
Loved, yes.
And it worked?
And psh, Fat Me Greasy? Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
So it was almost like a job. Well, I saw Michael Jackson's ID card. So you guys would have to have these ID cards at Motown or at Hitsville?
Not really.
So it wasn't
they gave
like,
them out, but you know.
Okay, I mean, you lose them.
Yeah, and then they knew who we were. You know, if we wanted them to walk through whatever department, hey, what's happening, Otis and Temp, y'all back in town? You know, so it never was no real big thing.
Oh, so it wasn't like, who you brought?
Yeah, right.
So how many hours a day would you guys
rehearse?
Rehearse, and how did Charlie find that much time to devote to each of the acts? Because he literally was doing everyone from the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
And coming up with these ideas. Like, what was his creative process to...
You know, I tell you, when I first became aware of Charlie's choreography, the Cadillacs in Detroit, they came to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Man, now, you know, Radio City is the largest indoor theater in America. Fox Theater in Detroit is the second.
Okay.
To see 5,000 people going crazy over what five guys are doing on the stage... And I said, that's what I want to do. Now, I was about 16 years old. So one day I met one of the Cadillacs outside of the Fox, and I asked him, how did they do all that? Who taught them that? And he said, well, young brother, you know, if you should ever want to do what we're doing, look for a young man named Charlie Atkins. 1964, we were at the Howard Theater with Gladys Knight and a big act, a run-out of acts. And Charlie was there. And I said, oh, my goodness, that's Charlie Atkins. And I sat and talked with him, and he showed me. I still remember the first move. He said, if I had you guys on the way you do the things you do, I'd show you what I would do. And he got up and did move and opened his arms. And then I said, man, but Paul Williams was our choreographer of the Temps. But they would work it out systematically, you know, for the hours. They would have, like, our Temps, you all would have from, like, 1 o'clock to 4. And then from 4 to 5, the Supremes would come in. You know, so they had it systematically worked out where he would give all the acts that needed to come into Motown for that a certain amount of time to do it. But we had to be there damn near every day. I mean, it was like being in school.
So it worked?
Okay. Oh, yeah, it worked. Mm-hmm.
So touring with the Hitsville Review,
mm-hmm.
Describe to our listeners the difference between... below the Mason-Dixon line, touring down south, as opposed to doing a show in Los Angeles, or was it the same? Just
No, it was different. Down south.
So did you guys dread going down south?
Not really, because we knew we had fans that wanted to see us, because our record was breaking out all over the America. But you can feel a different kind of wind chill factor when you got down in certain parts of the South. Like, I'm from Texas, and so we were on a Henry Wynn tour, who was the owner of the Royal Peacock in Atlanta, Georgia. So he would always have these big rock and roll shows. Mm-hmm. So we got off the bus in Texas, and we wanted to eat, get something to eat. And when we walked into this restaurant, white guy said, "Oh, we don't serve," and he used the N-word. Mm-hmm. And we said, "We don't eat them." And left, you know, and we had to find a place that we could go and you know, that would feed us, you know.
So did you guys use that travel guide?
The green book,
the travel guide that lets black artists and black travelers down south know what restaurants are safe or what.
No, we never did. It was a different kind of network, you know, because we would find out where to go. There were people that, like Sam said in his book, that would house us as black artists, you know, because a lot of hotels wouldn't take us, you know, because we were black. So there were certain homes and places down there that would, you know, let us stay and feed us and what have you.
And plus, you also had white people on the bus as well. So if it was a case of getting a to-go order of 23 dishes without you guys having to go in, like...
Not on our bus. It was really? All blackness.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yep.
Yikes.
Yeah. Damn. That's what we were saying.
Mm-hmm. Y'all needed a guide or something.
Yeah. Well, we had the best guide in the world. God.
You know, amen.
He brought us through all that.
What was the one city or state that you dreaded going to, at least in that period, in the mid-60s, early 60s.
Well, I hope I don't get in trouble, but Mississippi was the one.
Mississippi, goddamn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was her, y'all, mm-hmm. Not me. Yeah, but we were in Columbia, South Carolina, 1964, and the place was rocking. They had a rope right down the center of the auditorium.
Right.
Blacks on one side, whites on the other. So we were singing and saying, "Oh man, this show ain't cool," you know. So okay, we came back, same venue, same city, next year. There was no rope. Blacks and whites sitting side by side, booty banging, high-fiving, and having fun.
Wow.
If it wasn't for the sweat that we were sweating, you would have seen five guys on stage crying. The power of music.
Were y'all then, after that moment, because they showed that in the series too, but after that moment, did it change in the sense of groupies as well? Because was it now safe to have like groupies of all colors? Like, did you see the difference in that?
Well, the groupies back then.
I mean, how did that work? Like, when the...
You have to be very cautious of how you do that, you know. We always pretty much stayed within our color line, you know, because we knew how, if you did that, like Chuck Berry said he did, and his mm-hmm. behind got, no, we wasn't getting in there. Right. No. I am not going to the Gray Bar Hotel, you know, so.
Nice one.
The Gray Bar, damn, you got some stuff, Otis.
I love it. I've been told, Otis, you should do an Otisism, because that's the way my ear done. Oh, excuse me.
What a hell of a ring.
Hey, Shelly, I'll call you back. It's my manager. I'll call you back, Chell.
Shelly's still your manager.
Yeah. That's crazy. Okay, yeah. See you later, gone.
See you later, gone. I gotta write all this shit down.
Shelly's been the Temptations manager since the beginning, correct?
1966.
Woo.
That's loyal. That's amazing.
Yeah, he's getting ready to be 80 years old.
And still going strong, still sharp, and still...
Yeah, he'll be at the play. He's coming here because the stage Temptations, they are already rehearsing now.
Okay.
And I just talked with a couple of them, so he's coming in to sit and watch that and make sure everything is going correct.
That's amazing. So when you guys got to the late 60s and was easing into your psychedelic phase...
Sure.
I guess it starts with the Cloud Nine record.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, the addition of, is that when Dennis made his debut with the group?
Yeah. Cloud Nine came about, Gamelin Huff, who was a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Him and I were talking, Warwick Hotel, right up the road. So as him and I were talking, we heard this boom, 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 doom, 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 doom. So it stopped. We stopped and said, who in the hell is that? You know, with that, because it was so different.
Mm-hmm.
So we listened. And the guy said, that was Sly and the Family Stone. So went back to Detroit. Now, Norman Whitfield had recorded Ain't Too Proud to Beg, Please Return Your Love, I Wish It Would Rain. So we were doing the ballads and what have you. So when we came back to Detroit, Norman and I, we grew up together because he played tambourine on my first hit with John Mayne Matthews. Uh-huh. So I asked Norman, I said, Norman, have you heard this group called Sly and the Family Stone? And Norman was very cocky. No, man, I ain't heard no damn Sly and Stone. I said, well, you should check them out, man, because they're doing something that we should probably check out because we were letting David go at the time. Mm-hmm. So Norman, no. You know, he did all that wolfing and ghetto. So we went out of town, came back in. He had recorded the track to Cloud Nine. I said, oh, all right. He used the N-word on me. Let's go in here and record this here. And we went in and recorded. Now, we were spoiled because most cases when we would record any of our records, like The Way You Do the Things You Do, My Girl and whatever, or it just run up the charts, just from R&B right on to pop. Mm-hmm. So when they released Cloud Nine, it was spooky, you know, because we had gotten so used to having hits jump right on the charts right away. So about a week and a half, 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks. I said, oh my Sweet. God. Yeah. I said, oh damn, we didn't drop on this one. Motown called. He said, well, it finally took off, you know, and I guess our fans were saying, what the hell did the Temptations do? This is so different because we were just coming off a hit of Please Return Your Love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it really, you know, skyrocketed. And we got the first Grammy for the Temps and Motown, and that was 1968, and that was Dennis's first big hit with the Temps.
Time out.
Yes.
Motown's first Grammy in 1968?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. The Grammys weren't that liberal. I mean, the number one record, like...
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Welcome to America.
I mean, this is what you gotta figure, like,
Excuse me.
That's all right.
Steve
gets old.
You gotta figure out, like, records like South Pacific and The Mind of Bob Newhart was, like, number, like, those records were number one in the 60s.
I'm
like,
sorry.
The Beatles don't have a Grammy.
Yeah, I don't think they do.
Yeah, the Beatles don't have a
Wow.
Grammy. So it's just like, early 70s when, like, semi-inclusive.
All right.
You know? Yeah. But yeah, that is crazy to know that. But I'm glad you brought that up because I always wanted to know, one, were you guys even aware... Or at least Norman. I think it was more to Norman and less to you guys. But were you guys even aware of Sly Stone's kind of casual flip off on Hot Fun in the Summertime to you guys?
Somewhat. Yeah.
Like, do you guys know the story behind
it? No, I'm...
Okay, so Rose's parts of Hot Fun in the Summertime.
Yeah.
Was basically Sly like, all right, we invented the breakdown, the boo-boo breakdown, and, you know, like, just bucking a little shot. I never knew that, but it was aimed at either. Norman
Whitfield.
But did he ever respond? Did he ever meet Sly, or do you know?
Not that I know of. I don't know if he ever met Sly, because, no, I don't, he never mentioned it to me.
Oh, okay, mm-hmm. Okay. No, I've always been curious about that, because I think Sly, like, finally revealed it, like, maybe 15 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that... But as far as Norman Whitfield's productions, and the heavy militancy, militant message of the group, far away from wanting to be at the Copa, and you know, how did you guys manage to convince Barry Gordy that that's the direction of the group? Like a song like "Run Charlie Run." Which speaks of white flight in the most explicit terms possible. Like, how did Barry take that?
You know what, Quest? We were having so many hit records with Norman that when we made the transition from the ballads and, you know, straight up R&B and went to Cloud Nine, Norman told me one day, he said, you know, Otis, Barry and them don't even bother us anymore about quality control. Because every Friday, they would have what they call quality control. Everything that was recorded during the week, they would sit down at the end of the week and listen at it and say, yeah, and yeah, what? Hey, man, I think this needs to be a little more heavy bass. And not too much this, too much of that. You know, they would do all that kind of critiquing. And Norman would be part of that. You know, he would be in there because he was one of the producers. But, you know, we were having so many hit records with Norman and that they didn't never bother us about whatever we would come up with. Because when Norman came up with that song, Run, Charlie, Run, huh, the niggas are coming. I said, oh, Norman, you got to be kidding. Yeah, but that was Norman. He was that kind of a creative person outside of the box.
Were you guys at all confused about his, like, I know that he was trying to, as a producer, present the cinematic scope of, you know, have a lot of drama in his music.
Mm.
So songs like Masterpiece will let 6-7 minutes go by before the vocals even start.
Yeah.
Which is unprecedented. I mean, now it's standard.
Standard,
but
right.
But back then it was like, I didn't even know that Masterpiece had lyrics in that. Like, I just assumed that the whole thing was an instrumental.
I'll tell you something, Quest. It's very interesting that you should bring that up because that was the song that made me say, oh, we got to leave Norman. When we were over in Australia, I'm at Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me a breakdown of what was happening. Excuse me. And the article said that Norman Whitfield singers.
We wait, all of us. What?
Wow.
Wait.
The Norman Whitfield singers. And it was about Masterpiece. Boy, I mean, I was so damn mad, I called and said, what? So when we got back to Detroit, I told Barry, I said, we got to let Norman go. Because when you listen at Masterpiece, it's just only a little small segment of us singing, and everything else is all this here beautiful, elongated strings, horns, and doom, 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 all that. And Barry said, yes, yeah, you're right, because we had such a great run with Norman, but you know, when they started calling us the Norman Whitfield singers, I said, no, we didn't work all these years this hard to lose our identity. Yeah, just that quick. And but that's the song that made me call and say, we got to go. And Barry, there again, was always there for Melvin and myself. And that was the song that was the changing thing for us leaving Norman after about 8 or 9 years of being with Norman.
What was his theory for making these songs 13, 14 minutes long?
Well, Norman was, you know, he was very innovative. He always wanted to be different from Smokey and Holland, Doja Holland, and Astrid and Simpson. Mm-hmm. So he definitely always kind of, after Please Return Your Love, and when we ventured over to Cloud Nine, he always started to think out of the box. So, like I said, the Run, Charlie, Run, and the Cloud Nines, and the Message from a Black Man. That was just his way of expressing himself of wanting to be different. And he just started thinking that way. And we could not get him to come back to the Sweet Ballads. The only way we got him to do just my imagination was, I said, Norman, we out there. We hear what our fans want us to do. You got to come on and get off that side. Yeah, man. You know, to know Norman, very cocky, very egotistical. Wonderful friend of mine, but you have to know how to deal with Norman. So he recorded Just My Imagination, and that was the last record Eddie Kendricks did with us. And I saw us on Ed Sullivan, and we were singing Just My Imagination. And I looked at that, I said, boy, I wonder if the world can look at our face and say, those guys don't look to be too happy. Oh, next time you see it, because they showed it the other night, and we're sitting there singing on little blocks and, you know, looking just straight ahead, no emotion other than sadness. But, you know, that's the way it goes sometimes when you're dealing with very talented people. I was asked,
how hard was it to lose Eddie Kendricks as a singer? Because with Dennis.
Right.
And his raspy baritone. Mm-hmm. I mean, that fit in. But Eddie's falsetto is such a smooth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Was it hard to lose? And
yeah, it was rough to lose Eddie because he was such a talent, you know, far singing, and he's been noted as one of the best tenors group wise, in the business, you know. But I'm often asked about Otis, when you need to find somebody, what do you look for? I don't look for talent first. So see, that's the look I always would get. You don't what, Otis? I look for head and heart. You can have all the talent in the world. Excuse me, if you're an asshole of a person, you're going to negate the talent.
True.
And that's it.
I can vouch for that, actually, personally. I actually have all the talent in the world. But being an asshole has totally ruined it for me. It's unfortunate, but I'm accurate.
Well, how, when you, first of all, how are the exits and entry? I mean, I'm sure everyone in their mind would like to think like everything was amicable.
Nope.
And you know, guys, I'm giving my 1 month notice. Like how are they executed, and how fast do you have to find? Like, what was the network like? At least with the internet, I can go on and search.
Sure,
I got a drummer instantly.
Yeah,
but
no, it wasn't like that for us. We were at the Copa, and at the time, Paul Williams, Dennis Edwards, Melvin Franklin, myself, and Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie and myself got into an argument, so we were doing two shows at the Copa, and we stayed right around the corner, the Sherry Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to the hotel until it was time to come back to do the second show. We ended up doing the show with four. Eddie just said, kiss the monkey on the ball spot. I'm gone. And we had to do the show at the Copa with four. So it was no, fellas, after the show, I'm going to leave. Eddie said, yeah, I had to deal with that kind of stuff. Oh, I mean, I can go down in my home. That is a friend of mine that did a beautiful portrait of 22 different members. I got to ask Renee to do a new one. Oh, yeah. Now it's 24.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I was standing in my living room and look from Al all the way up until now. But I got to add Willie and Larry, because they would be, 24.
Was there ever a moment where you were like, okay, just, I can't lose Melvin? Like, was there a person, like, I just can't lose Melvin, or I just can't lose,
Yeah, well, I didn't want to lose Melvin.
Well, right, because in my mind, I'm like, who replaces Melvin?
Yeah, well,
you got lucky with Ray Davis. Like, if someone had to replace Melvin.
Right.
When I found out that Ray Davis was his replacement, I was like, oh, my God. That's like, because he always wanted to be a Temptation.
That's true. That's
you know
true.
What I mean? Yeah. So the fact that you got him.
Yeah. It was a short-lived thing with Ray, because he did For Lovers Only.
All right. Just one project, right?
Mm-hmm. And I would always send whomever would join the group to the doctor. We said, you have to be checked out, because we have been told that we are athletes that just sing. You know, because there are times we're on stage, we have to be on stage for an hour and a half. Mm. You know, doing all that stuff, you better be in good shape. So Ray went to our doctor. So I always go and get my annual physical for what we do. So Dr. Hagar said, well, Otis, I got some bad news to tell you. You need to look for another bass singer. I said, really, Doc? He said, he's not going to be here too long.
Oh, man.
Cancer. And now Ray didn't smoke. He didn't smoke. And true enough, we had to let him go because of health reasons.
Wow.
Yeah. But the guy that we have now, Willie Green, you know, people said, you Otis, have found someone almost the equivalence of Melvin Franklin.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Willie is a cold piece of work.
You mentioned, you know, this whole thing is physical. You have to go to the doctors. How do you, Otis, preserve your knees? I mean, y'all performed on hard bottom shoes for decades.
Yeah. Well, this here right knee now, I've had surgery on both knees, you know, from years of dancing, you know, and then rehearsing, you know.
Can you wear sneakers now? No, you're still going through the hard bottoms?
Yeah, I can wear pretty much. Only thing that bothers is like going up and coming downstairs. Wow. But other than that, when it's time to hit the stage, kiss the monkey on the balls, man. I'm there.
So that's the ass, right?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Just checking.
Wait, speaking of stage.
Yeah.
Who invented the Temptations microphone stand?
You know what? I have to give credit to David Ruffin. When they were rehearsing us for the Copacabana, you know, Charlie Atkins, Lon Fontaine, so we were around rehearsing, and we had a moment just to sit and kick it. So David said, man, you know, if we really wanted to be different, you know what we should do? We should get a microphone that with four heads on it, and we can stand around it. And so we just kibishing and whatever. And Lon Fontaine, who was helping us do our choreography, he said, oh, I know somebody that can do that. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, well, We drew up a thing with the pole and the four-headed mic. Lon knew somebody at the Star Trek back then. Somebody connected with Star Trek.
Wow.
Fixed that microphone up for us. And I gave it to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991. And
really?
The reason we stopped using it, because it was unique for us moving right there in that spot, but we wanted to open up. We couldn't open up because the mic was just right there. And,
right.
You know, so after a while, we said, man, the mic is great, and it has worn off its novelty and what have you. So we stopped using it and wanted to be spread out more on stage.
I always wanted to know, when I was 20-something, I had a particular light stand that was sort of like a boom mic that had two lights on it.
Right.
But it would always fall over. Uh-huh. And I always wondered how sturdy that microphone stand was. Like, if one guy were to adjust it and throw off the balance of it,
no.
Has that microphone stand ever fallen over?
No.
Ever or
no. Sturdy? The people did a great job of balancing it out with the four heads on it, and they hit the support system on each mic that if I should move mine, it wouldn't tilt the others.
He said so. Star Trek.
Yeah. I was about to say, that's
yeah.
That's yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it must be sturdy.
Yeah, it was.
I know that in the mid-70s, kind of a little bit after the Song for You house party era, you guys went to Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have Bear Beck. I forget the album before it, but
read between almost the first album with Atlantic.
I gotta look. But my question is, how hard was it to
leave Motown?
Leave an institution like Motown? And I know that, you know, the Four Tops went to ABC for a second, and some art, you know, the Jacksons went to CBS. Sure. So everyone was sort of making it.
I'll tell you something that's very, and they didn't show this in the movie. We still had time on our contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Barry said he got tired of running Motown on a day-to-day basis. It was beginning to wham down. Mm-hmm. So he started hiring, like, Abner, who used to be with VJ Records.
Mm-hmm.
Then Abner left, and he had this guy named Barney Ellis.
Okay.
That was running it. So we had a meeting with Barney Ellis, Ralph Seltzer, the attorney, Shelley, Suzanne DePaz, and the Temps.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Ellis, I guess he was pissed off because we had the Jackson and us had the same attorney, Abe Summers, a noted entertainment attorney. And he had engineered a hell of a contract for the Jacksons to sign with Epic.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we had the meeting with Mr. Ellis, it was a wind chill factor in the room. So he said, took his fist, bam! Sooner y'all get rid of Mr. Summers, the better things will be for you guys around here. The room went hush. I said, say what? Sooner you get rid of Mr. Summers, things will be a lot better for you guys around here. I said, oh no, we're not getting rid of our attorneys because you guys got somebody, people around here that we don't like, but I bet you won't find them because we don't like them. So he pointed down at the end of the table to Ralph Seltzer. He said, if Abe Summers call, don't you answer his call. I said, oh, Suzanne sat there, Shelley sat there, the group. So I said, well, I guess that's the end of the meeting. So we left. Marvin Gaye had to come in and have the same meeting with this guy. Susie Iketa, who was our project manager, she called me. She said, Otis, Marvin just left the meeting crying. I said, well, why do Barry have this guy running his acts off like this? Mm-hmm. So Barry was in La Costa on vacation. And he called me and he said, Otis, I am so sorry that went down. What can we do to rectify it? I said, we want to leave, Barry. Silence on the phone. He said, well, what kind of money can we get? I said, it's not about money. It's about respect now. We don't want to be here. So he was very saddened to hear that. He said, all right, I'll work it out, and we'll get past this. And they worked it out. We left Motown and signed with, we almost signed with CBS, but it was predicated on Gamble and Huff presenting, producing us. But
really?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Now, well, Kenny and I go back during the early 60s.
That could have been something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, because CBS was getting ready to get up off a ton of money for us. You know, but Kenny told me, he said, oh, this after I do the Jacksons, because he did the Jacksons, Enjoy Yourself. Mm-hmm. He said, no, I want to concentrate on my own act. He said, you know, I've always wanted to produce the Temps, but I'm just going to concentrate on my acts. And I said, I'll be damned. I said, well, Kenny, I can't argue with you, because if this is what you want to do, you know, you got to do what you have to do. And so Jerry Greenberg, who was the president of Atlantic Records, made a wonderful offer. And so Abe Sommers worked it out, and so we went to Atlantic Records. But that's how we...
So you guys didn't mess with Ahmet Ertegun at all? Like, I mean, was he...
Oh, well, yeah, he you know, was glad to...
He was a,
yeah.
Okay, so yeah. It wasn't hands-on and...
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, he really wanted us there, but Jerry Greenberg was the president of Atlantic at the time.
So you're saying the leadership of Motown in the mid-70s sort of caused sourness amongst...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Truth be told, shame the devil, yeah.
Wow. Uh-huh. I'm learning all these...
Truth be told, shame the devil.
Or kiss a monkey on the... Yeah, I'm learning all these... I'm learning these terms right now.
I'm glad to know, because it's funny, I was in watching that series, I was like, so it's always been sunshine and roses with Mr. Gordy and the Temptations. That just was an odd...
Well, you know, for Mr. Gordy and us, yeah, we pretty much always have had a wonderful, you know, relationship, even today.
And even in that part where, you know, they introduced Shelly, it's an interesting practice back then that I don't think, I guess it's not as practiced now in the music industry, where he introduced you guys to your manager, right?
Uh-huh, back then.
Right, back then.
See, at the beginning, Esther Gordy, Barry's oldest sister, was our manager. Mm. But I felt...
Wow.
I guess he felt, yeah.
He was all up in.
Who? Barry?
Mr. Gordy, yeah.
Why are you telling my family? Yeah. Yeah. But I guess he felt as though he needed somebody that could get us on the Ed Sullivan show and expose us to the big one. Yeah.
Okay.
Because he got us away from ABC Records, and we signed with William Morris. And that was a big blow behind us leaving ABC, because Shelly had to... Well, like I say, it was some things that went down that I won't go into too deep, but I've had a very interesting career.
We see a little.
But yeah. you guys returned in 80 with the mm-hmm. Power record, right?
Yeah.
Right. And Barry Gordy produced that himself, or?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Barry sat on Power because we were at Atlantic, mm-hmm. and Elvin DeBarge, excuse me, was the DeBarge was still there. And he said, I knew you guys was coming back. I said, really, Barry? He said, oh, yeah. He said, I know. It was just a matter of time. He said, I had worked on this song, Power. He said, but I did not have a group over here that could pull it off like I knew the Temps would. Because he loved Melvin's Power, boom, that bass. Mm-hmm. He loved Melvin's bass. So
that was before Pro Tools, so to do that 7 minutes in a row, man.
That's right. You're right.
Did he? Okay, how many takes did that? Like, was that a lot of cutting and pasting, or he just straight
seven? Through?
Wow,
straight through.
That's hard, dude.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah. He got behind that mic, close his eyes, and he would ball his fist, and he was there, just like a metronome, right in that pocket. And Barry said, "I knew you guys were coming back," and we did Power. 200,000 immediately, right out the gate. Mm-hmm. It was a riot down in Florida. The stations across the country got off of it because they didn't want the lyrics that was so powerful and power.
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't want to incense it to go any further. And we were hard, you know, broken because the record was moving. It was going. But that incident down in Florida made the disc jockeys back up off of it because... It was tenuous times even at that time.
So was it your idea, I guess, in 82, and I guess to commemorate the, by that point, I don't know if it was 20 years or 30. I don't know how long. When did you guys officially start in 60 or 62?
What, Motown?
Yeah.
61. I have a contract in my home that my mother signed.
Okay, 61. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so 82, when the reunion album happens, that's to commemorate the 20th. Whose idea was it to broker
our fan base? I have a saying that I have since and been saying quite often. A few people around me say, Otis, I see what you mean when you say, the world loves us, but we did not love ourselves. We would let matter what shouldn't matter. Mm-hmm. Drugs. I mean, I'm just saying it the way it is.
Yeah.
Drugs.
So it was. The reunion was sort of bittersweet.
Yeah. When
did you guys tour behind that record, or was it just?
Standing on the top. Yeah, we were touring. Our first date was in Detroit, Michigan, at the Fisher Theater. David Ruffin came and he said, Otis, I promise you, I won't be doing all that crazy shit that I was doing before. I just want to get back in the group. I promise you, I'm straight. I ain't gonna, because I was the last man to hold out, because Melvin was saying, come on, bro, let's do this here. You know, the fans want to see
us. You were the last to hold out. I felt like it was your idea, like, let's bring him back in.
No, because I knew what they were doing, even when I had my own set of temptations. Okay. You know, because I would see Eddie from time to time. And Paul, he was already gone, mm-hmm. because Paul had passed, 70, 71, thereabout. Mm-hmm. But I knew what David was doing. I knew what Eddie was doing. And, you know, and I'm not sitting here denigrating these guys because I love them still. But, you know, like I said, tell the truth, shame the devil. So even Kenny Gamble, we went to Philly, and Kenny has always wanted to produce the Tims. And Jimmy Bishop was the spearhead of trying to get it together. But I guess for whatever reason, Jimmy Bishop bowed out.
Wow, Jimmy Bishop. That's like legendary name in Philadelphia.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. So, anyway, we persevered, and I said, all right, Melvin, let's do this. So we got together, and we started rehearsing, and we got a very good show together. First day, well, we broke an end down in a place in Texas. The customary thing for us, go off and break the act in off the beaten path, so when we get on the show enough high visible road, we'd be tight. Mm-hmm. So when we got to Detroit, Fisher Theater. People wrapped around the building. And like I said, I'm not trying to denigrate anybody, but the time we got there, Ruffin was Ruffin. Yeah.
Do you think that was a fear of his? Like, what's your assessment of not being able to let those demons go? I've, at least in my particular field, I know that cats that all they have to do is just step up to the plate and do what they got to do. And
but he had a crazy upbringing too, though. He's David. Right. David had a crazy upbringing.
Yeah, it was kind of.
But I always just wondered, like, him not being able to get it together. I mean, obviously that stems from a fear. I don't know if that's survivor's guilt. I don't know if that's you know, like.
Well, of course, you know how it is. Everybody can handle success. Success can be a strong aphrodisiac, you know, and it's all, I mean, on the real side, there have been so many different parties for us throughout our career that we were in Detroit, and I had to go off to myself and pinch myself. So I don't believe this here shit is really happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, all kind of doors was opening up to us. I mean, all kind of adulation, you know, women, you know, all kind of things, you know, mm-hmm. that if you're not strong from within, oh yeah, it can bug you out, you know. So, but we all handle success differently.
But you mentioned, like, your mom signed your first contract. Like, right. You had a foundation.
Yeah.
And I know briefly in the series they mentioned, like, David, he said he was, like, raised by a pimp. And, like,
he was.
He had all. Yeah. So in that foundation, and a lot of y'all had some good, like, even Melvin, you could tell, had, like, the foundation. His mother was involved.
Mama Rose.
Yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, but Ruffin did. He had a very sordid life, you know, in the sense of, they called him at first Little David Bush. Mm. Oh, yeah, because he was living with this guy named Eddie Bush. And so he took David under his arm wings and called him Little David Bush. And David had about 6 or 7 singles before he joined the Tims. And I would see him at various record hops. And the brother was a cool piece of work, though. I mean, in the good sense. I mean, David Ruffin threw that microphone up, spin around, drop to his knees, and as the microphone was coming down, he'd grab it and go on into his act. So one day he said, Otis, I want to sing with your group. And I was surprised because I said, wait, say, back that train up. Say it again. And he said, I want to sing with your group. I said, boy, if you were to join us, we'd really be something else. And he knew that we had a very strong reputation in Detroit as far as a group and doing what we do. And so he joined the group in 63 when he started hanging with us. So it was six, you know, at the time because of Eddie, Paul, Melvin, David, Al, and then David. And we used to close the show with Shout. And we're at this place called Chappie's Lounge. And as we closed, they kept calling for us to come back. So we went back two more times. And the third time, they kept calling. And Al said, man, we've got to go back. They keep calling us. So Paul said, man, what are we going to do? We can't keep going back there closing with Shout. We've done it two times. You know, we got to let it go. Al was drinking. And when Paul said, no, we can't go back, Al said, MF, I'll hit you with this bottle.
Right, that was
and,
real.
And I was the only one that could listen, that Al would listen to. I was just a little bit off time because when I could read Al's eyes, his eyes would get the, that kind of focus thing. I said, up! And by the time I tried to grab his arm, right across Paul's nose.
No!
I came out the club and leaned up against the door, came out of the dressing room, leaned up against the door, and Eddie, Melvin, and David said, man, what's wrong? What's wrong? And they saw the look that I had on my face. I said, Al just opened up Paul's face with a beer bottle. But check this out. Took Paul to the hospital. I said, Al, I'm going to have to let Al go. I mean, Paul, we're going to have to let Al go. And no, Otis, no, don't do that. I feel we're getting ready to make it. So I'm not going to have that kind of fighting. I said, we can have disagreements, but I just thought his eyes was gone because he hit him until the day Paul died. He had a scar right across the bridge of his nose. So we were at the Fox. And, you know, like I said, Paul was the one that started us to be noted for our choreography. So Paul and Melvin did this in movie where they would jump down and do the seal. Boom. The place at the Fox went crazy. So I said, hey, Al, come on, man, let's get a piece of the action. Al said, no, no, we're going to stay back here. We the pretty boys. And that's when I said, got to let him go.
Yep.
Got to let him go. And when he came off, I said, you got to go, man. Enter David Ruffin. And that's the how the Temps, you know, the noted Temps became what we are.
Was there any interaction with ex-members while they were on their solo tenures? Like, did you guys feel like a certain way about Keep On Trucking or any of David Ruffin stuff in the solo period or even?
Well, I was happy to see that David and Eddie were able to still do, you know, because very talented guys. Mm-hmm. Now, My Whole World Ended, that was originally written for the Temps.
Okay.
But Norman Whitfield, not Norman, Harvey Fuqua and Johnny Bristol, they could never get it to us because Norman Whitfield was a string of hits. So when David left, they put it on David, and that's the originals that's doing the background on My Whole World Ended. And, well, Eddie, you know, I knew Eddie would always be successful because he was such a unique talent singing-wise. So Frank Wilson, when he did Keep On Trucking and Boogie Down, you know, Eddie was very, very successful.
Who, in your career, as far as production is concerned, you guys worked with everyone from the Corporation to Norm Whitfield to
Rick James,
Al McKay,
yeah,
Earth,
yeah,
Wind & Fire, and all his cats. Even, Benny Medina even worked on the reunion record.
Yeah.
I've never seen his name there.
Uh-huh.
Who, what is your preferred, not effective as far as who brought us the most hits, but Who was your favorite producer to work with as far as like who really understood the group, who was pleasant to work with?
Oh, and I would have to say Smokey first.
Okay.
Smokey being a group singer. Smokey was always organized when he would bring us whatever song, The Way You Do the Things You Do, My Girl, Since I Lost My Baby. He left the background harmonies up to us. He would show us the basic part of the song. But Smokey was always organized, easy to, you know, work for, record. Because when we did My Girl, how that came about, he came and saw us at the 20 Grand, a noted club in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And after the show, he came back and he was marveling on how great we were. And he looked at us, and then he looked at David. He said, I have a song for you. And so us being young, dumb, full of, you know what, we said, man, bring it on. We can sing anything. And we came here to the Apollo. And we, Smoking M, our headline, we were co-stars and field access on that. So in between the shows, we would rehearse with Smoking. And went back to Detroit after rehearsing with him for My Girl. And he put the background and the leads on. And when Paul Reiser came and added the strings and horns, Smokey was sitting at the console, you know, working the boys. And I said, Smokey, I don't know how big a record this is going to become, but I think we got one on our hands. The record was recorded that fall of 64. They released it December 28th, 1964. We were at the Apollo February 1965. Barry sent us a telegram congratulating us as number one, sold over a million records. The Beatles sent us a telegram congratulating us, and I still have those telegrams at home now. But I always think back that I said I knew this song was going to be something. I knew the song was good at the, you know, with the essence of us. But when Paul Reiser added the strings and the horns, it gave it a whole nother daylight. And true enough, when we do that song today, it's like people growing up out of the ground like trees. They just started standing up. And we made the mistake like years ago, the record did what it was going to do. So Paul was in charge of the rundown. He said, well, we can take My Girl out. It did what it's going to do. So we took it out and we did the show. Quest, y'all. They call us every name except the child of God. I tell the guys even today, I said, there are certain songs we can never, ever take out. My Girl, Just My Imagination, Ain't Too Proud to Be, Can't Get Next to You, Papa Was a Rolling Stone, Losing You, Now Treat Her Like a Lady. So, like, we have a new record out now, album out now, and so I'm tasked with, how in the hell are we, I'm going to do this here? Because right. We only have a lot of like amount a
four
of time.
Hour, it's going to be a four-hour show.
Yeah, man. And yeah, so,
how long is the average Temptation show?
Hour and a half.
To pack all this, yeah. Hour and a half. I mean,
that's
with banter in between and non-medleys.
Just one hook, right? No, like, just go to one hook and then go to the next song.
Well, we got.
Y'all remember this? Y'all remember this?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, no, we work it our way. Well, like Ain't Too Proud, we do all of Ain't Too Proud. We do all of My Girl the way you do. Fortunately, you know, we try not to never cheat our fans because they paid their money to see a show.
Right.
So, but yeah, you know, hour and a half, you know, we try and insert as much as we can so they can say, whew, boy, the temp's still jumping around, you know, after all these years, which that's what they're saying now because we just did a big show in outside of Maryland and it was packed. And I have been getting calls about, man, and the most amazing thing, he said, but the CO is still up there keeping up with the rest of them. I said, I'm not keeping up with them. They keep up with me.
Right? Yo, what do you say to like the young artists who, you know, there are some artists who maybe two albums in that are tired of doing their song that was the big
Quit.
Hit.
Anytime you have fans that's spend their hard-earned money to come see you, and you're going to tell them, I'm tired. Oh, we don't want to do that. Then you should leave it alone.
I want to do all my new stuff.
They should leave out the business.
That's what we think too when we're in the audience. But you know,
see, yeah. Well, I'm an artist, and I'm telling them if that's the attitude you have. Get out of the business. Yeah. People spend their hard-earned money to see these songs, and you don't want to do them because you're tired.
Tired of doing them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to use the N-word of please.
How of the groups that you guys have inspired, especially the 70s onslaught of groups, everyone from Blue Magic to
Boys to Men,
Dynamics as periods. Well, I was just thinking in the 70s, but oh, I mean,
New Edition, yeah.
Well, yeah, just
NSYNC. Hang on.
No, because the thing is that I feel like when it's 20 years down the line and it's someone young, then you're more willing to accept, like, yeah, I influenced them.
Oh, okay, I get where you're going.
But how did you guys feel, like, with the onslaught of all the 70s groups that are based on you guys? And I mean, like, all those groups, the Choice 4, yeah. the
Enchantments. And
yeah, Enchantment, like, just all those groups that have the same breakdown, the falsetto guy, the baritone guy. And did you guys feel a certain way?
Well, you know, of course, we took it as a compliment. You know, and when you sit, I mean, I tell you, all the way today. When I watched Bruno Mars, when he did the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. I saw three important elements in his show. James Brown, Michael Jackson, and the Temptations. Now, he's here in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. So our influence reach from now all the way back then runs the gamut. And whenever I see somebody that's doing us, mm-hmm. I say, okay, I like them because the Temps has influenced them. You know, so you can't do nothing but take it as a compliment.
You guys covered Bruno on the new record, right?
Yeah, we did one of his songs. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And yep. Remember the Time, right?
Remember the Time. I tell you, when I got the list and they said, oh, just pick out what you want to do for the new album. Mike had invited me down to the studio when he was recording Remember the Time, and him and I were in his trailer talking, you know, and when they said, Mike, we're ready for you, but him and I were sitting in his trailer talking about Days of Yo, because I can tell you what brought back to mind, because we were talking about, we were in Chicago and Jesse Jackson had Operation Push. Yeah. And they had the 10 of us on stage. So when I guess the girls said, uh-oh, they're getting ready to come off stage, all these women and girls start coming to get on the stage. So one of the security guys said, what are we going to do to protect these guys? There's 10 of them. Somebody said, get a U-Haul truck. They got a U-Haul truck. They put the 10 of us in there with security. And it was pitch black in there. But Mike said, Where's Otis? And somebody cut the light on inside the truck. And I said, Mike, I'm right here. I never will forget the look that he had in his eyes of love. Now, mind you, he didn't ask about his brothers.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't ask about the other temps. Where's Otis? Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm right here, Mike. And he looked up and he had the damnedest little I love you look in his eyes. So, but I was there at the taping of Remember the Time. So when I saw that, I said, oh, no, we got to do Remember the Time, because it gave me that kind of remembrance.
That's so cool. In your entire catalog,
mm-hmm.
if you could just, what to you is your three personal quintessential favorites in the Temptations catalog?
Right out the gate, My Girl.
So even though you performed it every day of your
yes,
life.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
that's you.
That one. I had to sing Too Proud to Beg, because Norman brought that track mm-hmm. to my house, because we all lived in Detroit. And I said, man, the track is, ooh, you know. So Ain't Too Proud would be the second one. You know, I'm a big Temptation fan. I could go a lot longer than three, but.
You can only pick three.
Just My Imagination.
Okay. What one under the radar song that
I was gonna ask that? Yeah,
never really made it, like a favorite of yours that didn't make it.
Like one you think that deserves a second look that didn't get a shot the first time.
Now this is one I really enjoy listening at, and it was a guy that worked at Motown named Steve McKeever.
Yeah,
you know Steve
Hidden Beach.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
He used to work at Motown.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. He said, Otis, that Elevate Eyes. I said, really? I said, I've always liked that.
Wait, see, I hear Elevated Eyes. That's a whole. Yeah. I work at 30 Rock.
That's HR. Huh.
That's HR. We ain't allowed to have that. Yeah. We get sent to the principal office for Elevated Eyes.
Oh, yeah. Well, young lady, she's since passed. She was a forensic psychologist, and her and I were talking. She said, Otis, have you ever heard of the term Elevate Eyes? I said, hell no, I ain't never heard of that. And she said, well, if you are working in the blue-collar field and a young lady walk by and you be to my, damn, baby, you show, oh, yeah, excuse me, and go and continue to work, mm-hmm. she can go to the human resources.
HR.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Lose your job.
Wow.
Oh, we're not alone.
No.
I thought that was something that we just made up in 30 Rock.
Okay. But what made me really say, oh, okay, you're not the only one. Oprah had a forensic psychologist on her show and asked her the same thing. She said, no, I've never. I said, well, I don't feel like Boo Boo the Fool in if Oprah ain't heard her, you know. And I said, you know what, Kathy, I'm going to write a song called Elevate Eyes. And a young lady texted me, and she said, Otis, you need to do something with that Elevate Eyes. So that would be one that I really, and it would kind of be apropos with what's happening with the Me Too thing, because this song tells about how you really should, you know, you can see a young lady, but you don't trespass. You just let her know yeah, she looks nice and what have you.
Your peripheral.
Yeah, but, you know, you have to watch that. But that one, I told her I'm going to still work that out and find somebody to do it, because the lyrics and the track, you know, it's tight.
Now's the time.
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. I see. My last question. How come you didn't sing more?
You know what?
Prominently on the lead.
Quest, you're on point, because I was the lead singer at, when we were The Distance.
Okay.
Because Billy, my valet, he went on the internet and found Open Your Heart and what else did it? It was another song that I did. But my thinking was when we got to Motown, and, you know, because it wasn't like I couldn't sing lead on it. I just say, hey, man, I don't give a care who is singing as long as we make this money. And it wasn't like, wait, bro, you getting paid more because you sing lead? Oh, hell no. I want to sing lead. So it wasn't that kind of thing.
Oh, everybody got the same. I was wondering about that.
No. Excuse me. No. Everybody got the same pay.
But then that's weird, Otis, because since you were founding member and then so Melvin, so, but regardless, if it's a new guy, whatever, we all the same.
Yeah, that's where it was at, wow. Back then. Yeah. And but Tom Bell, we did a album with Tom Bell, and he recorded us, and I was just humming something. And Tom stopped. He said, "You the one I should be recording." I said, "Really? Why you said it?" He said, "I like your voice." I said, "Oops." too late, you know. We had, you know, finished recording, but my attitude has always been like, "Hey, man, I just want us to make it." You know, my ego didn't get hung up on the thing. Well, I got the same lead. I'm the group leader. I found this shit stuff. You know, no, it wasn't that with me. It just let us all make money and be successful, and that's it. You know, but I guess I never did really make any real bones about it. Just.
Yeah. Did you make bone? What about the writing process? Because you said earlier on you wrote some songs for the Temptations, but did it continue on? Because it sounds like
I'm still writing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. On our latest album, Temptations All the Time, I did along with two other guys, Waiting on You, Elevator Eyes,
mm-hmm.
Treat Her Like a Lady. Yeah. Yeah. So no, I love writing when I can, you know, get a chance to do it. So yeah, that's my other thing of doing it.
Well. I knew you have another 300 years in you, so
I love you, Quest. Yeah. I'm gonna, like I said, I'm gonna ride the hell off the horse. When I get off the horse, it'll be ball.
And that's how we have to end it. Yo, thank you very much, Otis Williams, for coming on Quest Love Supreme.
Thank you.
On behalf of Boss Bill, Sugar Steve, What's Laia, Fontigolo, and I'm Pay Bill. This is Quest Love of Quest Love Supreme. We will see you on the next go round. Thank you. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. This classic episode was produced by the team at Pandora. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.